Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han and today I'm joined by Stephen Timms, who has been the Labour MP for East Ham since 1994 and who also sits on the Exiting the European Union Select Committee. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Thank you, Jennifer. I ought just to clarify, of course, that the Exiting the EU Select Committee does not at the moment exist since the dissolution of Parliament before the election. I will certainly seek to be elected to the new committee, but who knows what will happen.
I was about to ask about that, actually, because I've not heard much coverage on this. I wasn't sure whether the committee was tied to the elections or not, but clearly it is. So you will seek to be... So you are assuming that the committee will still be in place after the election and you're hoping to get elected into it?
Yes, the committee will certainly be established again.
Okay.
First step we will need to take will be to elect a chair of the committee. And I know that Hilary Benn is going to seek to be elected to that, but we'll have to wait and see what the outcome is. And once that's been done, then the different party groups will elect their representatives and I will certainly, I expect to seek election from my Labour colleagues, but whether I'll be successful, I just don't know.
So for the average person who doesn't necessarily follow politics super closely, they might have already forgotten what exactly the Exiting the European Union Select Committee is and what it does. So could you give us a bit of an overview of that?
Yes. Well, every government department has a select committee in Parliament to shadow and scrutinise it. So the task of our select committee has been to scrutinise the work of the Department for Exiting the European Union. So we have taken evidence on various aspects of Exiting the European Union. We've produced a number of reports already with our advice about how this task should be accomplished by the government. And we've had in front of us David Davis, the Secretary of State, and I'm sure that he will be a regular visitor to the committee in the new parliament once the committee has been set up. So it is the remit is very clearly to scrutinise the work of that particular government department.
And has that resulted in any sort of tangible changes this far?
I think it has. Of course, it's not always absolutely clear why the government does some of the things that it does. But for us, there has been some clear shifts in government policy. And I'll just mention one of them. In an early report we published early on this year, we called for a white paper to be published setting out the government's approach to Brexit. And in due course, a white paper was published. Not as helpful a white paper as we think it ought to have been, but nevertheless, it was a white paper. It was properly published for everybody to read. And I think that was a response to the Select Committee's recommendation, and it's a step that I welcome. One other point I ought to make about the Select Committee is, as I've said, there isn't a Select Committee at the moment. It hasn't been set up yet. That will all have to start once we've had the Queen's Speech. We don't even yet know when the Queen's Speech is going to be. And it's not entirely clear how quickly the Select Committee will be set up. Now, I had a word with the Speaker, John Bercow, yesterday, and I hope that all the Select Committees will be set up before Parliament goes into its summer recess in late July. But that will, it depends how long the Queen's Speech is delayed, and the process inevitably, because we've got to first of all elect a chair and then elect the various members of the committee, all of that will take a while. So whether it will be done before the summer recess of Parliament, unclear. I hope it will be. I think everybody would like it to be. But it may turn out that because of delays elsewhere, the select committees will not be set up until September.
There have been some critiques that the Brexit select committee is fairly impotent when it comes to sort of getting any sort of real influence into Theresa May's government, which has this far been very set on sort of doing her own thing. This obviously is subject to change as a result of the elections. What would you say to those critics?
Well, I think it certainly is subject to change as a result of the elections. And everybody knows, there wasn't any secret about it. Theresa May decided to call an election because she believed she would get a landslide majority that would enable her to force through the particular version of Brexit that she has favoured, and she wouldn't really have to take much notice of anyone else or any other views in Parliament, whether expressed by our select committee or by anybody else. Now, as we all discovered last week, that plan did not work. Not only did she not get a landslide majority, she didn't actually get any majority at all. And so it is now certain that the government will have to listen to other views in Parliament expressed by our select committee and others as well. It's going to be a big theme for the next year or two in Parliament. And because they don't have an overall majority, the government will have no alternative but to consult with others. And so I think that is going to mean that the select committee's influence will be significantly greater following the general election outcome than it was in the period before. I think there was the committee did have some influence before, but it's going to have significantly greater influence given the result of the general election.
In the wake of the election, there have been calls for Theresa May to set up a new collaborative sort of cross-party group to find a way forward. Is this not what the Brexit Select Committee is already doing? Do you think these calls are to set up a new sort of independent body that's not maybe dependent on the election cycle? How do you see that working together? Or is it in fact the same thing?
I think you're right. There has been a widespread recognition that the government is going to have to talk to other parties much more seriously than it would have done if Theresa May had got the landslide she was hoping for. Now, we don't know, and I think there is a good deal of discussion about this at the moment, what the forum, or maybe fora, for those discussions are going to be. I'm sure the select committee will be one of them, but the government might decide it wants more formally to incorporate the various parties in Parliament into the discussion. It might decide it needs to set up some entirely new kind of body with representatives of the leadership of the various parties on it that would work alongside the select committee. So at the moment, we just don't know what form these discussions are going to take, what the fora for them are going to be. We do know the select committee is going to be set up, and that will clearly be one place where such discussions will happen, but there may well need to be, the government may well choose to set up another forum, or maybe more than one forum. We'll just have to wait and see where they get to. What is undoubtedly the case, however, is they are going to have to take account of different views to their own, and I welcome that.
There's also been a lot of talk that, especially because of this, a hard Brexit might now be completely impossible to get through Parliament. Could you reiterate, just for those people that don't always keep up with politics, what exactly a hard Brexit is and whether you do think it's impossible now?
A hard Brexit, the term, I mean, it's a bit contentious. Some people don't like the use of the term, but I think it is quite a useful term. It is the form of Brexit that Theresa May appeared to favour before the general election, which would essentially tear up most of the formal links between the UK and the rest of the European Union. Now, there are lots of people, who, including me, who think that that would not be a good idea, and that we need to retain some of the links that we've had as a result of our membership of the European Union. For example, I think there is a strong case for the UK, although leaving the European Union, to remain a member of the single market. There is also a strong case, a slightly different one, for the UK to remain a member of the customs union. One area that I've thought about and want to do some more thinking about is I think we need to retain in the UK some elements of the current arrangements around free movement. Now, at the moment, anyone who is a citizen of the European Union can freely come to the UK to do whatever they like. I don't think that is going to continue to be the case once we've left the European Union, but I think there would be significant advantages in the UK saying, for example, that if you are an EU citizen and you have a firm offer of work in the UK, then you can freely come to the UK. So there are a whole range of areas in which different people, including me, are arguing that we should retain some of our current links with the rest of the European Union and not simply cut them all off. And those are all regarded as varying forms of a softer Brexit than the one that Theresa May was intending to embark on before the general election. A particular concern in the Prime Minister's mind, I think, is she doesn't want the UK to be subject in any way to the decisions of the European Court of Justice. And the various kinds of softer Brexit almost inevitably would involve some continuing influence on UK law for the European Court of Justice. So that's quite a significant distinction, I think, between a hard Brexit on the one hand and softer versions of Brexit on the other.
Okay, I want to move back a little bit to the election. Congratulations on increasing your majority in East Ham, by the way.
Thank you.
So what do you think swung the votes in favour of Labour this time around?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think people are going to be thinking long and hard about that for a long time. But a very significant factor, it seemed to me, was a new enthusiasm for my party, for the Labour Party, on the part of young people. And I think what happened in the referendum, where the participation of young people was quite small, was a bit of a wake-up call to a lot of young people who felt that the decision that had been made was not in their interests. And I think that did prompt more young people to get involved in this general election to try and make sure that their interests were represented this time around, given that they weren't a year ago in the referendum. Beyond that, there were some very specific reasons in the Labour Party manifesto for young people to be enthusiastic about the Labour Party. One of them was our commitment to scrap tuition fees for university education, which clearly did attract enthusiastic support from a lot of young people. I think there's also been a sense for quite a long time that governments, certainly since 2010, perhaps even before 2010, have recognised that voting amongst older people is at a much higher level than amongst younger people. And as a result, governments have needed to protect the interests of older people and not had to care so much about the interests of younger people. And I think the Labour manifesto reflected the fact that younger people were feeling disadvantaged by this. And so there was a direct appeal in the Labour manifesto to young people, which, to the surprise of many, was actually effective. It does seem to have galvanized young people into voting this time, and overwhelmingly, as far as one can tell from the evidence that's appeared so far, that they, having chosen to vote, they did vote for the Labour Party.
So do you think, with young people playing such a crucial role now, that social media and the internet almost overtake more traditional venues of campaigning in importance, or are sort of boots on the ground strategies and coverage in the mainstream press still important?
I think they are definitely still important. And of course, one of the striking things about this election campaign was the newly prominent role of the most traditional form of political campaigning of all, which is having large open-air rallies addressed by a political leader, in this case Jeremy Corbyn. Somebody made the point during the election campaign that more people have heard the leader of the Labour Party in this election than probably the leader of any other party in any previous election since Winston Churchill after the Second World War. So, and it does look as though those big rallies did have a significant role in this election in galvanising support and building enthusiasm for the Labour Party. So while social media clearly had a very important role, so did some very traditional forms of campaigning as well. And certainly canvassing, knocking on people's doors, standing up as I did in high streets and talking to voters as they went past, I think all of those things had quite a significant impact in this election. And the fact that the Labour Party had far more people willing to do that than the other parties did was a big factor in our favour.
Did you also see the number of young people sort of getting involved in the actual campaigning process rise, as well as the turnout and the amount of people voting for Labour?
Yes, we did see that. I think it'll take a while until the picture is completely clear. In my own constituency, the people who turned out to campaign on the whole were the same people who turned out to campaign 2 years ago. But I think what happened was that there were a lot of new people who went to help out more in constituencies that are more marginal than mine, and that proved to be a big boost to the success of the Labour campaign.
I want to go back to Jeremy Corbyn for a second, because I think the amount of bad press that he's received in the run-up to this election, and indeed since being appointed leader of the Labour Party, is extraordinary. What do you attribute that to?
Well, Jeremy has been a Member of Parliament for a very long time. He has taken some very distinctive positions as an MP, different often from the positions taken by his party. And so that background does make him quite a controversial figure. And it's on the record, I didn't support his leadership bid in 2015, nor in 2016, when he was challenged by Owen Smith. So there's plenty of things that people who want to attack him can draw on from his history. But Jeremy has actually achieved some quite remarkable things, I think, as leader of the Labour Party. I mean, the first one was that our party more than doubled its membership, and it's now, the size of the party has now risen again. That's a very important political achievement, partly just because all those membership subscriptions coming into the party office is a big boost. Running a political party is quite an expensive process. The more members you've got paying their subscriptions regularly, the more funds you've got to enable you to do that. But also, of course, the more people you have willing to campaign and to support the party in an election. So the fact that our party is so much larger now, has so many more members than it did a couple of years ago, is a very important achievement, and I think Jeremy is entitled to much of the credit for that. The other thing that he did, and this was what we were talking about a moment ago, is successfully to engage enthusiastic support from young people. And young people have been disengaged from politics in the UK increasingly over the last few years. Jeremy has managed to change that. That's a very important achievement, not just for the benefit of the Labour Party, but for the benefit of politics and of democracy. Because if one large cohort, particularly young people, it loses interest in democracy, then democracy is in trouble. The fact that Jeremy has managed to shift that, I think, is a very, very important and welcome achievement.
So can I ask why you didn't support his leadership bid?
Yeah, the two bids that he made, both of which he's been successful with, neither of which I supported. My fundamental concern was the difficulty I thought he was going to have in securing a majority for the Labour Party. And of course, we didn't secure a majority for the Labour Party, but he has done much better than I expected in being able to bring into play this very large number of votes from young people and from others who haven't bothered to vote in the past.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please feel free to subscribe to us and follow us on the usual social networks at Brexit Podcast and at brexitpodcast.com to stay up to date on all the best Brexit news and opinions. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Paul, and our theme song is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod.